This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century History Guy. How might America be different today if the Union had not won the Civil War? What legacies of the Civil War have an impact on your life? These are a couple of questions posed by curators at the American Civil War Center in Richmond, Virginia. Visitors are encouraged to answer each question on a post-it note and stick it to the wall there before they leave.
We had a post up there one time. The person actually used like four post-it notes to get their point out. And one of the things that they went on about was, here again is another example of how the haves managed to convince the have-nots to fight their battles for them.
That's Christy Coleman, president of the American Civil War Center. She says that the notes visitors leave often reflect their regional affiliations. Northerners, for example, tend to answer that question about the war's legacy with a certain amount of, well, triumphalism.
You know, if it wasn't for this war, we wouldn't have expanded the rights to so many and, you know, opened our gates and broken down the power structures that, you know, would have us all truly slaves, et cetera, et cetera.
This April marks the 150th anniversary of the Civil War's beginnings. But despite the passage of all that time, Americans in many parts of the country are still trying to understand what the war really meant. Go ahead. Google the recent controversy over Virginia history textbooks or the dust-up over South Carolina's commemoration of that state's secession, or just spend some time with Christy and those post-it notes in Richmond.
In our last show on the Civil War, we looked at how the election of Abraham Lincoln set off a cascade of events that resulted in war. Today, we're going to pick up where we left off, but we're going to shift our focus from the politicians to the ordinary men and women who, in the spring of 1861, found themselves staring war in the face. In the South, most of these people did not own a single slave, and in the North, only a small minority were committed abolitionists. All of which leads us to our central question for today's show. What motivated these people to pick up weapons and fight one another in the Civil War?
We're going to return now to Christy Coleman, the president of the American Civil War Center in Richmond. When we spoke to her, she told us about another one of those post-it notes, another question that yields particularly interesting results.
Where do you consider your strongest allegiance? To your state, to your nation, or some other place? And it's interesting that you can always tell when there's a political upheaval going on in our current society because the percentage of those answers shifts dramatically. You know, prior to the 2008 elections, for example, you had a lot of people identifying themselves very strongly as Americans. I am an American. This is the USA. I'm very proud of it. And then in 2010, you see a shift and people are identifying via their states. You know, I'm a proud Virginian. I'm a proud Texan. I'm a proud, you know, what have you. And it 9 out of 10 times is Southerners that are identifying via their state.
Peter and Ed, I know this is going to shock you, but, you know, it sounds like these folks leaving their post-it notes are applying their biases from today's world, imposing it on history. So I'm curious to know, have Americans done this specifically to interpretations of the Civil War?
Well, you know, it's not just Americans, but it's historians too. I'm sorry, you know, Peter. I hope you can keep your sobbing to a minimum. But you know, as long as there's been a professional historical set of organizations since the late 19th century, we've been able to see the academic historians sort of shifting their interpretations of the Civil War as their own times changed. Let me just give you a thumbnail sketch of how that has been. After World War I, widely seen as a war without purpose, the American Civil War was interpreted by our predecessor historians as a war without purpose. The leading historians of the Civil War talk of a blundering generation that got us into that mess.
Yeah.
World War II comes, immediately revised our understanding of the Civil War.
Good war.
Exactly. Sometimes there's evil in the world, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. says, and you have to rise up to defeat it. And that's what the Civil War as well as World War II was all about. Then Vietnam comes along and we might expect that we would go back and reinterpret the Civil War as a big mess. But instead, historians are saying, look, what else is going on now in the 60s and 70s? The Civil Rights Revolution. Let's go back and look at abolitionism and Reconstruction and focus on that. And then when you get into sort of the, you know, very frustrating sort of decentered wars of the 1980s and 1990s, there's a real disillusionment among a lot of scholars with the Civil War in general. We start discovering guerrilla fighting and all kinds of breakdowns of morale and all that sort of stuff. So that's kind of where we've gone. Every single stage of our own warfare experience in the 20th century has disrupted our understanding of the American Civil War.
Well, Ed, your summary of 20th century developments being read into the Civil War is terrific. But it strikes me that one of the key 20th century developments is people are drafted for wars in the 20th century. And I know there was a draft in the Civil War, but how did that actually play out, this tension between all those folks who volunteered and the eventual draft in both the North and the South?
The draft is important, but we'd have to acknowledge that both the North and the South benefited from enormous degree of volunteerism.
Right.
You know, both armies were filled with men who could not wait to show their dedication to their nations.
Yeah. But we could go back further to the Revolution, to the first American
wars.
Let's do it. You know, the wars that, in effect, define American political culture, that idea that Jefferson articulated in his first inaugural address, that we are the strongest government on earth because of the devotion of citizens to defending the country. It's the idea of the citizen soldier, that our country's wars are our wars. This is a free country, and we die freely for our country.
Well, as a matter of fact, it strikes me, Peter, that the war driven by popular commitment that Jefferson dreamed of didn't actually happen until the American Civil War.
Right.
Because the War of 1812, the Seminole War, the Mexican War, all those were deeply compromised, deeply conflicting, disappointing those kind of wars, right?
That's a good point. But what I would say is that Jefferson wasn't really inventing the citizen soldier. What he was doing was creating a political culture, a civic culture, in which there was a lot of vicarious fighting, and that is that party formation in the antebellum period before the Civil War in effect mobilized people in a semi-quasi-proto-militant way. They would march to the polls. They would feel righteous anger at enemies, even if it were the other party. But nonetheless, it was that belligerent frame of mind, the idea that it's incumbent on you as a good citizen to be ready to fight at the polls or wherever the fight is taking place because fundamental issues are at stake. And I think that helps explain the amazing preparedness of the American people to slaughter each other in the Civil War.
I could argue that this actually is what brings on the Civil War. As you think about the timing of the coming of the Civil War, it's determined a lot more by what you're talking about, Peter, than by any change in the actual status of slavery. Or it's not that the North becomes modernized enough to fight against the South.
No.
What it really is about is the party system. Because for the last 30 years, people have been used to thinking of two parties. The names of the parties and the identities of the parties change. But what happens is this two-party system, which had been around now for decades, really just begins to unravel in the 1850s. First, you have the Whig Party begin to show signs of weakness. Then the Know-Nothings emerge, and the Democrats splinter apart. Then the Republicans arise. And once this sort of bipolar, maybe in most senses of the word, party system shatters. You have all that sort of polarizing
That's exactly right.
Everybody's used to thinking us or them.
Yeah. So help me, guys. Let me try to understand this. All of these passions are rattling around, but in the past, they've lined up through the mechanism of parties, and those parties have been distributed roughly evenly between North and South, so the passions don't get channeled into these sectional rivalries. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Well, I think the key thing, Brian, is we shouldn't imagine that there's something going on in individual people's minds and that there's a flashpoint or a threshold that people cross and say, I'm going to fight now. I'd propose when you think about the run-up to the Civil War that there is an excess of patriotic feeling. And it's not necessarily focused, and that's the whole point of it. It's only in the process of mobilizing for the war that this ambient patriotism that Americans North and South share becomes focused in a particular way.
So where was Cuba when we needed it?
Well, that's a great point.
To use a late 19th century example.
Yeah. No, that's what Americans were looking desperately for, some kind of war to fight elsewhere.
Yeah.
And we had Mexico. I mean, that proved to be problematic, but it
that bought us a few years
yes,
before it blew up in our face. But, you know, I think the strange thing is, if you go back and look at the mobilization of the Confederacy, there is no new language. There's no new idea that the very people who have been for the Union and who've been all about loyalty and sacrifice and, you know, fealty to the fathers and to one another just switched the entire apparatus of loyalty from the Union to the Confederacy, literally overnight.
Yeah.
I mean, this patriotism you talked about could be directed toward an entirely different and new and warring nation.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing that makes it a fight inside the family, is that there is no warring ideology except that one family possesses slaves and the other does not.
Yeah, and we, you know, we talk a lot about war weariness, imagining that somehow there's only a certain amount of enthusiasm and it's spent. It plays out over time. Instead, it's almost as if that energy, that original commitment, in some ways it grows.
The cause becomes more coherent in both the North and the South.
That's a great point.
And so that's the thing, is we don't want to think about it as, okay, I'm doing an inventory of my emotions and loyalties. Yep, there's adequate supply to go fight and die. Instead, it's like, yeah, I'll go fight this one battle.
Yeah.
Or I'll join every other young man in my community going off for this. And so the initial motivations don't become what James McPherson has called the sustaining motivations. And one of the things we have to do about the entire Civil War is remember that it's an unfolding story with different kinds of motivations and context, and not just one monolithic substance that we kind of analyze like a chemical ingredient.
Right. So we should be asking why they fought when.
Exactly. They're constantly playing catch up with events. They act and they go, okay, what did that mean? And so the Civil War is not driven so much by ideas as it is interwoven with them.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that we've entered the time dimension into this discussion, and I'm going to enter another time dimension, and that is, it's time for a short break. When we get back, we'll hear why the word union quickened the heartbeats of men in the antebellum North.
You're listening to a special Civil War anniversary edition of Backstory with the American History Guys. This is Backstory, the show that takes a topic and considers it from the perspective of three different centuries. I'm your 18th century guy, Peter Onuf.
I'm your 19th century guy, Ed Ayers.
And I'm the 20th century guy, Brian Ballow. Today on our show, we're exploring the motivations of soldiers on both sides of the American Civil War. Most people agree that slavery was at the root of why the war started. But if most Southerners were not slaveholders and most Northerners weren't abolitionists, then why were so many thousands of people willing to put their lives on the line?
That's a question that's really challenged historians for many years, in large part because there are so many answers that are at least partially right. Now, there's a historian, Adam Goodhart, who's the author of a new book called 1861, The Civil War Awakening. He's also one of the main contributors to Disunion, a New York Times blog that chronicles the events of 150 years ago. And in his research for both projects, Goodhart has discovered that there was an enormous range of considerations that factored into people's decisions in the lead-up to the war.
I found a letter in a sort of a bundle of letters in an attic a few years ago on the eastern shore of Maryland, a bundle of letters from an army officer from the spring of 1861 trying to decide which side he was going to go with. And on the one hand, he was a slave owner. He was from a slave-owning family. He'd grown up in the southern state of Maryland. On the other hand, he'd been an army officer. He'd been under the Stars and Stripes since he was a 14-year-old cadet at West Point. And he's having a correspondence. He's stationed out at a fort out in Indian Territory in what's now Oklahoma. And he's corresponding with his wife and his brother back east. And some of the decision has to do with slavery. Some of it has to do with the Union, and some of it has to do with which way Maryland is going to go. But then he's also talking about, well, what's this going to mean for my own career? His wife writes something that really stuck with me. She said, "It is like a great game of chance." And I thought, well, gosh, he's trying to decide, well, if I join this Confederacy, will I end up as one of the founding fathers of a new nation, or will I end up as a traitor being tried for treason?
In the end, that officer decided to stand by the Union, or at least by his career in that Union. And if his choice about which side to fight for seems like a tough one, then what about all the ordinary civilians in the North who had to decide whether to fight at all? Joining the Army would mean leaving their jobs, and yet tens of thousands of them flocked to answer Lincoln's call for men. So how do we explain that?
Well, fortunately, Peter, we don't have to explain it. We brought in our colleague Gary Gallagher, University of Virginia historian, who wrote a book on this very issue. It's called The Union War, and it argues that while the Southern states went to war to protect slavery, the vast majority of Northern men who volunteered to fight did not oppose slavery. Even after Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, Gallagher says that ending slavery was for most of them purely a military strategy. That's why they went along with it. He says that if you ask these guys what really compelled them to take up arms, they would have answered that it was their deep commitment, hold your breath, to union. Now, if you're scratching your head on that one, you're not alone. I was a little confused by it also. You know, Gary, that I'm 20th century guy on this show.
I've heard that.
And I just can't understand how all these men could fight, and many of them die, for something as abstract as union. Can you explain to our listeners what union meant to these men?
I think what union meant at the absolute base for the mass of white Northerners was it meant a small d democratic republican system that gave a common person a voice in his own government. Men are voting. Only men are voting. We know that. In his own government. And it provided economic opportunity, not a guarantee for economic success, but much greater economic opportunity than any aristocratic or oligarchic society had. And that was something that they treasured. And they had imbibed Daniel Webster's great rhetoric. It's everywhere. It shows up in advertisements, liberty and union, liberty and union. And what they meant by liberty is not what we would normally think about. Liberty is often tied now to your attitude towards slavery. That is not how they would have deployed that word for the most part. Liberty for them meant freedom to enjoy these political rights and a chance to move ahead in an economic sense.
And I'm really struck by the comparative nature of your answer. We think today we live in a world of globalization.
Right.
But you were saying that these people woke up thinking, I may not have much money, I may not have much education right now, but I'm special because I can vote and I can have a say in my government, and millions of people around the world don't have a chance at that. Am I getting that right?
That's absolutely right. And they not only thought it, they wrote it down. And they wrote it down sometimes in language that makes it clear they had very little education. They're literate but barely literate. And they had a poster example of this in the presidency. Abraham Lincoln literally did what they believed this system allowed people to do. Literally go from
That's the opportunity.
And they compared themselves again and again and again to Europe. And they were well aware of the failed revolutions of the late 1840s in Europe. They believed that if the Union failed, if after an election, a legal election, if the party that lost that election could simply destroy the nation because they weren't happy with the result, then the aristocratic, oligarchic, monarchical Europeans could look and say, we told you a democratic republic could not work.
So it's almost as though they viewed those slave-holding, aristocratic-leaning Confederates as the kind of shock troops of the aristocratic model around the world that was just waiting for America.
They wouldn't have said aristocratic leaning. They would have said the words they used the word oligarch came up a stunning number of times to me. I was really struck in doing the research for this book how often the word oligarchy was applied to the slaveholding class of the South. They called them aristocrats. They called them oligarchs. They said they were absolutely inimical to what the United States was about.
So in a way you're saying they were fighting against those slave holders.
They were, yes.
They just weren't fighting against slavery.
They weren't
They weren't terribly upset by slavery per se, except that to have slavery, you needed slaveholders, which defied the very concept of a democratic republic.
That's absolutely right. And they sought to punish the slaveholding class, which had caused the whole problem in the first place, they believe. And there's no better way to punish the slaveholding class than to take their slaves away from them, because their property in slaves was the basis of their power. And so get rid of them.
Yeah. Well, Gary, let's get down to brass tacks. What public opinion polls did you consult for your study?
I used the three major ones that were available in the mid-19th century. There are no public opinion polls.
Oh,
darn. What I did was try to put different kinds of evidence in conversation with one another. For example, I read – there were two major illustrated weeklies at the time, the equivalent of Life and Look, really. Harper's Weekly and Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper. I read every word of every issue of those for the whole war to see how this sentiment
That's
tracked.
Why I haven't seen you for years.
Yes, I've been – yeah, I don't have a tan anymore. I also looked at soldiers' letters. I looked at letters from people behind the lines. I mean, I used different kinds of evidence. Fully aware of the fact that this is not a scientific – there's nothing scientific about this. And anybody who pretends they can get a scientific sample of letters from the Civil War is either deeply ignorant or dissembling because it just can't be done.
Well, this has been so informative. We have a guy on the show who claims to know about the 19th century, Ed something. Ed Ayers, that's right.
I've been one of Ed's admirers since I was a little boy. I mean, I grew up sort of now, idolizing Ed.
Now he is getting up there in years. Now that you've explained to us why the North fought, I thought we could bring Ed in. He just happens to be standing outside looking just so anxious to get into this conversation. Ed, come on in.
Hey, everybody.
Hey,
it's great
Ed.
To see you. I didn't know how long you'd leave me with my face pressed up against the glass there.
I know.
So I'm
I
glad
know,
you brought me in.
I know you've been listening in. And I'd just be curious to get your thoughts about what Gary has had to say, especially about Union and about why men in the North fought for Union.
Well, you know, it takes a little bit of the drama out of it to say that I think he's exactly right about the motivations of people at the beginning. I do think, though, if you read our textbooks, there is a general sense embodied in Abraham Lincoln of a sense of moral growth over the course of the war. And that is Northern soldiers come into contact with enslaved people as African Americans fight 200,000 strong in the United States colored troops. As people begin to wonder if this amount of bloodshed must not have a larger redeeming purpose, as Abraham Lincoln says, some kind of providential reason to obliterate slavery. People often think that the white North develops a greater understanding of slavery and its injustice over the course of the war. Would you agree with that or not?
Not in the way you put it. I think the big problem we have is not accepting the fact that for most of the white North, Union was a completely sufficient reason to fight the kind of war they fought. Union meant so much to them. I mean, a number of historians have said Union wasn't worth the loss of a single life. Well, that would have been stunningly wrongheaded to people who lived in the loyal states. I don't think there was a great moral shift. I do believe that some Union soldiers surely changed their views about African Americans when they saw slavery up close. But many others had earlier notions about black people actually confirmed, and their letters make that clear. The prejudices came out more on the wrong side of things from our point of view. I think there's quite a variety of reactions to seeing slavery and seeing African Americans up close. In terms of Lincoln, Lincoln's second inaugural, of course, is the place that we go to see this change and this almost spiritual take on what the war was about. Mm-hmm. But Abraham Lincoln's message to Congress in December 1864, which is after the elections, there's no reason for him to pitch this to the loyal population if he didn't think that most of them still focused on Union. He said that in a great war such as this, you need to have one thing, I'm paraphrasing him, in which everybody believes. And he said, in our war, it's Union. He said, killing slavery is one of the means to achieve that great end that we all agree on. That's December of 1864. So I just think that union is most important in 1861, 63, and 65.
So, Garrett, since we know that we're writing history for today to help us understand what the Civil War means for us, you are taking advantage of the fact that we've now recovered the African-American component of the war, and you don't try to displace any of that. But you're trying to restore an understanding that, in alliance with that, was a dedication to union. Does that speak to our current time in some way that we need, you think?
Well, I guess my principal goal isn't to speak to our current time. I think it's important in our current time to understand the complexity of our past. And I think that if we're going to come to terms with the Civil War, we have to understand that it isn't exactly what we wish it had been. But one of the points I make is that it's sort of miraculous that a mass of white Northerners who were as racist as they were would be transformed by this giant military event into a population that believed slavery must be killed. And I think that is a radical transformation within a mid-19th century context. And I think it shows the capacity for growth and change in the direction we would say is the right direction, even if it's not for exactly the reasons that we would prefer that it had taken place. I think that's important to know.
That's Gary Gallagher. He's a colleague of ours in the history department at the University of Virginia. And his book is called The Union War. If you're just joining us, this is Backstory, and we're talking about the reasons soldiers on both sides of the Civil War were motivated to fight. We've already heard that most white Northerners did not go to war in order to end slavery, even if they ended up supporting that as an eventual outcome. But Peter, Ed, what about black Northerners? I mean, a lot of our listeners have probably seen Glory, the movie about the African Americans who fought on behalf of Massachusetts and on behalf of the Union. I want to know more about those guys.
Well, you know, the first thing to understand is they were not permitted to fight until 1863. Right. So the war ultimately is half over before African American men are allowed to fight. And there's widespread skepticism in the white North that many of them will. But what happens is as soon as they open the doors to black recruitment, African-American men of all kinds of backgrounds surge into service. Black men who could have set out the war put themselves in harm's way to help make sure that this war is a war that does fight against slavery. And this strikes me as one of the great miracles of American history, frankly, that these thousands of African-American men, whether previously held in slavery or born free or having made themselves free, go fight for a nation that has held them in slavery.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And why? Because they have the idea that fully extended to its logical conclusion, to its consistent meaning, the federal nation of the United States would guarantee even their freedom.
Well, I think that's a great point, Ed. There are values that Northerners are invoking about freedom and liberty and about the reason that we need to fight for the survival of the Union. And African Americans, free and enslaved, take those ideas seriously in a way that most white Northerners don't take them seriously. That is, they make a local application. Northern whites are saying, our freedom is what's crucial. Well, those ideas, once they're in the air, even Jefferson the slaveholder said, all men are created equal. That idea is hard to put down. And all of a sudden, in the midst of war, it seems to have this power. It's really the story of imagining an America that could be, but that wasn't.
You know, in this moment, there's a incredible quote from Frederick Douglass, who goes into the Civil War deeply suspicious of Abraham Lincoln, of the Republican Party, even of the Union cause. Why are we fighting to maintain union with slaveholders?
Right.
He does say, now that black men, black families, can fight for not just their freedom, but for the very survival of the United States, it changes everything.
Yeah.
He says, once put an eagle on their buttons and a rifle on their shoulders, and things can never go back to the way they were.
And what difference did this make in the actual prosecution
of the war?
Well, you have 200,000 African-American men fighting on land and sea that you would not have had otherwise. Mm-hmm. And they come into the United States purpose just when the North really, really needs men. Yeah. Matter of fact, let's not fool ourselves. That's why they are enlisted in the first place.
Yep. Right.
Is that despite all this language of union and self-sacrifice, not enough Northern men stepped up to sustain the purpose.
Dear wife, I've enlisted in the Army. I'm now in the state of Massachusetts, but before this letter reaches you, I will be in North Carolina. And though great is the present national difficulties, yet I look forward to a brighter day when I shall have the opportunity of seeing you in the full enjoyment of freedom. I would like to know if you are still in slavery. If you are, it will not be long before we shall have crushed the system that now oppresses you. Great is the outpouring of the colored people that is now rallying with the hearts of lions against that very curse that has separated you and me. Yet we shall meet again, and oh, what a happy time that will be when this ungodly rebellion shall be put down and the curses of our land is trampled under our feet. I am a soldier now, endeavoring to strike at the rebellion that so long has kept us in chains. Tell Eliza I send her my best respects and love Ike and Sully likewise. Your affectionate husband, until death, Samuel Cabell, Private 55th Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry, 1863.